didn't know that you went to the fair already, Aaron Carroll.
I did.
Oh man, I'm behind. You're not keeping me in the loop. I'm at the incidentaleconomist.com is Dr. Aaron Carroll's blog, and every year he goes to the Indiana State Fair and takes pictures and blogs about the food there, titled Adventures at the Indiana State Fair 2014. And it's hilarious and sickening as always. We're joined by Dr. Aaron Carroll right now, who you can follow on Twitter at Aaron E. Carroll. The Incidental Economist is the blog. He's a contributor to the New York Times Upshot, and his healthcare triage videos are available on YouTube, and they go viral every time. Lots and lots of people love and watch them. Most recently, there is a video up that you just posted about healthcare in Switzerland. Yeah. You've visited Germany and Singapore and France and other nations describing their healthcare systems. But let's get quickly to the Indiana State Fair, sir.
Yes, sir.
All right. What do we have here? A fried mac and cheese?
Oh, that was Sydney's choice.
Your daughter Sydney got fried mac and cheese.
Yeah, so, you know, no is not allowed at the state fair. So on that one day, pretty much whatever they want to eat, I will let them try. And that was what she wanted.
The word no is not allowed.
The lamb tent.
That doesn't seem that bad, fried macaroni and cheese. But now I'm looking at
a picture
of a fried...
You got to see it next to the fried green beans and the fried pickles. And I mean, come on, fried macaroni and cheese? Like, you got to take macaroni and cheese and like bread and then deep fry it? Ugh.
No, that's not... I'm just trying to build up here because we've got, you know, you can fry anything. And one of the things I do see here that's fried that someone apparently ate, looks like Jacob... A deep-fried Milky Way, your son.
Well, everyone eats the deep-fried Milky Way. That's just part of the deep-fried
candy cart
combo.
No, they don't. I mean, they don't all eat it.
No, I meant all
that's
of us. I mean, that's part of the deep-fried candy cart combo. I mean, you get the deep-fried Milky Way, and not the fun size. You get the full size. A deep-fried Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, two deep-fried Oreos, and for a buck more, they'll throw in a deep-fried butter.
Chris, what of these have you had, Alfred, Melanie? When you go to the fair, do you eat this trash yourself?
Of course. Okay. I had fried cookie dough, and it was fantastic. Fried chocolate chip cookie dough.
Do you know what an elephant ear is, Alfred?
I do not.
I used to make those as a kid.
That's something you shouldn't say on the radio. Chris, elephant ear?
Yeah, I feel like there was Greek diners or something that would sell something like an elephant ear back home. I think they called it kershaki leaves or something like that. I don't go to many fairs, so I feel like the last thing I had at a fair was a Zeppelin's.
Which is just fried dough. Boring. What is an elephant ear, doctor?
Basically, I'm not exactly sure how they, you know, because they're always sold at the same place as the funnel cake. I think the funnel cake is more cake batter, and the elephant ear is more of a crisp batter. But basically, it's a ton of batter, and they just throw it in the deep fryer and they let it cook.
You're right.
With like sugar and cinnamon.
You're right.
Like
funnel
so
cake.
Blasé. We don't even eat it. I mean, funnel cake is what you get at like your third-rate state fair. Or like, you know, elephant ear. You get elephant ear at like probably the baseball park. You know, that's just not that big a deal.
That's not that impressive.
No, elephant ear.
What did you see this year that, I mean, you're never surprised, but that you'd not seen in the past? Ooh, well, the redneck burger. Wow.
Cheeseburger ball on a stick was a cheeseburger basket on a stick is what they called it. That was the signature food of the 2014 Indiana State Fair.
What is that, a cheeseburger basket?
They take like all the stuff you put in a cheeseburger and they like mush it into a ball and they cover it in some kind of like batter and breading and then they deep fry that and put it on a stick. Because the problem with cheeseburgers, I guess, was you couldn't eat it with your hands, but I don't know. Also baffling to me, but it was that was new and that was popular. They now make funnel cake evidently in like 19 different batters. That was sort of new. The funnel cake ice cream sandwich was new. I'd not seen that before.
How do you do that? How do you deep fry ice cream? I guess that's what deep fried ice cream is.
Well, you can deep fry ice cream. You cover it in like batter or cookies and then quickly fry it. But you got to do it fast because otherwise the ice cream melts. But the funnel cake, what they did was they just replaced the cookies that you would normally use in like an ice cream sandwich or whatever the cake is. They replaced that with funnel cake and then they covered the entire thing in chocolate.
How do you? You and the kids, don't you get sick after eating all this stuff?
You don't feel so good about yourself when it's all over.
Well, that's fine. You shouldn't get physically ill.
Bites. Nobody gets their own thing. So that's sort of how we manage it. It's like we share everything, so you only wind up getting a bite or two of each thing. So that way no one loses it on like any one item. But everybody gets sort of to choose something, at least one thing.
Do we know that? I mean, I feel like we just constantly have what we know to be true turned on its head in terms of information, new studies, and so on. This stuff, anything deep fried, when you fry something, that's fattening and it's bad for you, no matter even if it's a vegetable.
Right. Well, right? Oh my God, yeah. One of my favorite cars is called Dr. Vegetable. And it's entirely deep fried vegetables. That's all it is. In fact, they added corn dogs this year, which I guess is now a new vegetable. But when you watch it getting done, there's no way any of this is healthy. I have a great picture. We ate the like magic potato thing. They take a potato and they run it through this grinder, so it turns an entire whole potato into one long like Mobius strip of thin potato. Like it's like one huge potato chip, and then they fry the whole thing at once. And then you eat it. And I showed pictures on how it's made and everything else. But when it was over, I looked at the kids and I'm like, who spilled soda on the plate? Because it looked like soda was like just all over it. And they were like, we didn't even have the soda near there. And when I touched it, it wasn't soda, it was like oil. And that did not make us feel good either.
Oh, boy.
It was pretty bad. It was a low moment at the fair.
Talking to Dr.
It very quickly.
Talking to Dr. Aaron Carroll on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll, 866-994-6343. Because of Robin Williams' suicide, we've been talking about depression today,
yeah.
And we're going to talk about it a lot more. We don't talk about it enough because it's depressing, and we're doing a radio show, but we talk about important issues all the time. So why not this one? I mean, how pervasive is depression? And you know, I asked earlier Dr. Viravago of Stanford University, as a neurosurgeon, was on earlier, Dr. Carroll, about the fact that a lot more people are depressed apparently now than they used to be, but how much of that has to do with how we measure it?
You know, this is one of those things. It's depression is so hard because we don't have a test for it like we do so many other diseases. That you know, you get a biopsy and you're like, "Bap, you're depressed." It's you know, we use what the DSM-4 and soon the DSM-5 to try to strictly define what is depression and what is not, but it's a soft call. You know, it's like when do you actually have clinical depression? It's difficult. Part of it is also that we probably way underdiagnose it because, you know, probably so many people have it but just don't recognize it and don't realize that it's something you go fix. When your arm hurts, you go to the doctor. When you break a bone, you go to the doctor. When you cut yourself, you go to the doctor. But when you're depressed, often people are, you know, think it's something you're supposed to tough it out. So it is prevalent and it's pervasive and it's probably seriously underdiagnosed.
What? You know, when we think about all the drugs that are used to treat it, it's not that hard for even someone as dumb as me to say, all right, you have a chemical imbalance in your brain, and that's diagnosable. We can prove that somehow. And here's a drug that creates the balance. So if you're missing a chemical, this drug adds that chemical, and you feel better.
Yeah.
That seems like a good idea and a good way to treat an illness that someone might have. But I worry about these drugs. What do studies show us about these drugs? Because you hear about the trying to get off them. You hear about the addiction. You hear about, you know, a lot of people are just not, you know, anti-drug altogether. What do we need to know about the drugs that are commonly used to treat depression? And I think what the main issue that you've addressed and others have is that they're over-prescribed by some doctors for some patients. Is that right?
Well, here's the thing. First of all, you got to be careful when we throw around the word addiction, because addiction implies that people are getting a secondary gain off of it, and they can't get off the drugs without getting sick in some way, in some other way. If you have a condition and it treats your condition, and if you go off of the drug, your condition comes back, that's not addicted. I'm not addicted to, you know, my, you know, anti-inflammatories because I have ulcerative colitis. I need the anti-inflammatories, but I'm not getting like some sort of high off of it where if I went off of it, I'd start vomiting or go through withdrawal or anything. I would just have the recurrence of my disease. And in many ways, that's what people who are on antidepressants have. They're not addicted in the sense that, well, now they're cured and they would love to go off of it, but they're getting some sort of other thing from it.
But there are withdrawal symptoms for these drugs that are different from your depression.
Withdrawal implies addiction, implies you want to get off of it, but you can't. And so that's not necessarily as clear because, you know, here's part of the problem is that it's doing studies with these kinds of drugs has been very difficult, and there's a lot of conflicting results. And I'm not a total expert in this, but I've read enough articles to make me question whether the absolute effects of the antidepressant drugs are huge for lots of people. I'm sure that there are some groups to which they are lifesavers, but it's not clear how much benefit they provide widespread. It is clear that in some people they seem to have a great benefit. I'm a big proponent of therapy, you know, at least coupled with the drugs, if not, you know, even in place of them. I think that sometimes that's the core. But it is clear that some people have some sort of chemical imbalance. The problem is that, you know, the brain is complicated, and we don't understand it that well. And the idea that, you know, just one neurotransmitter being too common or too rare is the cause of, you know, problems like depression, is we hope that that's the case, but we're not positive that's the case. And that's often how we treat it, by, you know, looking at like serotonin or something else and trying to use a drug that will increase or decrease the amount of serotonin. So it's, we just don't know. Part of the problem is, of course, we just don't do a ton of research in this area compared to other diseases. For something so prevalent.
Why not?
Because it's not, it's in the past, it's had a stigma. Why not? I mean, it's like as if there's any rationality to the way that we study diseases in general. I don't know how many times I've been on here talking about the gargantuan amounts of money that we put into some cancers while we ignore other cancers, and those cancers probably kill more people than the cancers we're looking into. Why we spend so much money on diseases that are relatively rare, but we're willing to just forego huge problems that are so common, and depression is one of those. Whether it's because it has a stigma, whether it's because we can't, you know, have a nice poster child campaign around it, whether it's because it seems soft and therefore we can't, you know, point at it and like someday say, oh, well, now there's a cure because we've not adequately defined it. For whatever reason it is, we don't invest enough research resources into these things. We don't invest enough time and money and effort and science into looking what causes it. How do we catch it? How do we treat it? And so it's woefully understudied, and that we don't have sort of the cures or the drugs or the resources that we wish we did, that we constantly seem to be fighting for in other areas. I don't know. Nothing is rational to me sometimes.
Kelly in Kansas City, you're on Stand Up with Aaron Carroll's on Twitter, at Aaron E. Carroll. Give him a follow and tell him you heard him here, and thank him, folks, because he does this out of the kindness of his heart every week with us. Kelly, go ahead.
Hi, Pete. It's Kelly. I'm a pharmaceutical rep. I sold drugs for depression for 15 years. I'm also a very big patient advocate and a mental health warrior, if you will. And the death of Robin Williams, I think, should become a platform for us to have some national education. When it comes to depression, there's no national campaign to know what causes it, what treats it, how it works, what it does to the patient, not only the patient, but the caregivers and the family members. Depression is an illness that touches not just the patient, but every single person
sure.
that patient comes into contact with. Suicide is currently on the CDC top 10 list for leading causes of death in the U.S., which is a hideous statistic.
Well, when you look at kids, it's in the top few. I mean, when you get to kids and even adolescents, it's like number two or three. So
it's number three, and for men, it's number seven, and for women, it's number 14. By the year 2020, the World Health Organization said that statistically, depression will be the number one cost burden to the U.S. healthcare system, which no one's doing anything about it. There are 21 national cancer institutes in this country. There are 8 national Alzheimer's centers in the United States. There are 0 for depression. And in 5 years, it's going to be the number one cost burden to our health system. It's egregious. It's criminal. And people are dying every single day. And when Robin Williams died, I think that should be a call to action. Everyone thinks it's selfish. Everyone thinks, how could they do it? No one understands what it's like to be depressed. Unless you have been. Depression is the paralysis of hope, and patients that are depressed have no hope. And the drugs that are out today are only getting people, about 30% of the folks can get to remission, which is a cure, if you will. But 85% of the folks that do get to remission 85% will have a relapse within the first 5 years. And with every relapse, the depression gets worse, the treatments become unsuccessful, and it's a slippery slope. I just feel strongly that our providers, our healthcare groups, our insurance companies are not doing enough for the depression. And, you know, there's a difference between being less depressed and being happy. I just think there's an egregious undereducation.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, on the TV, we know what causes cancer. We know what causes obesity. We don't know what causes depression. But by God, we should be educating those folks who are in the throes of depression. And if you're crying and you finally go to your primary care doctor, that's like the second or third phases of depression. The first phases look like aches and pains and just kind of, you know, irritability. There's a lot of irritability. But only 10% of primary care physicians are even catching that.
Dr. Carroll, anything that you want to push back on? I mean, this is a powerful call from the.
I think it's like I wouldn't go so far as to say we know what causes cancer and we know what causes other diseases, because it's not as if we've wrapped up, you know, other things as well. But I do think there's a problem, and there's a sense that I think a lot of people sort of ascribe depression as to being sad, or you know, depression is just not being happy, or you know, just sort of being mopey, and that's not the case. And that a significant number of people have real depression, I mean, where they really can't sort of pull themselves out of it, and it is not a matter of will. There's something just absolutely wrong. But, you know, so much of the problem is that, you know, we rally only at the end here. You know, everyone is, you know, everybody's very upset about the fact that Robin Williams committed suicide. But, you know, when somebody goes into the hospital and gets treated for their cancer, the whole neighborhood's going to get around and support. You know, friends and family are going to show up, and it's going to be real kinds of support and campaigns, and people are going to march. When someone has depression, and even if they had inpatient, no one's coming out to talk about it. No one rallies. No one supports. No one does any of that.
No one's bringing casseroles.
Right.
Dorothy Hamill.
So it is not just the medical community. It's like there's something bizarre and wrong about the way that we as a society treat the problem as well, where we want to just not acknowledge it or talk about it. You know, fighting depression is nowhere near as noble somehow as fighting cancer, even though I hate the fighting the fighting metaphor anyway. But you know, having cancer, having heart disease, having something else is something that everybody wants to rally around and support. Having depression does not have that kind of level of support built in. If anything else, it has a stigma, and that makes it very hard.
Which is why we need a national effort. All of the cancer institutes, the Alzheimer's Institute, they all have national funding, not to mention foundation funding for all of these places. We have got zero. We need a national campaign for education because of just what you said.
Yeah.
Dorothy Hamill is a, you know, obviously famous person. She suffered from breast cancer and recovered, and then she suffered from depression. And she said, you know, the main difference between my illness of cancer and my illness of depression is when I had cancer, people sent flowers and brought food.
Yeah,
that's a powerful. Listen to this email from a listener named Matt. Just heard your caller, the clinical psychologist, weigh in on antidepressants. My wife was on Cymbalta. When she tried to come off with her doctor's direction, it was horrible. Look up the symptoms: brain zaps, severe mood swings, body pain, suicidal thoughts, to name a few. These drugs absolutely change your brain chemistry. Most doctors don't tell you what happens once you start these drugs.
Right, but
Dr. Carroll?
All I'm saying is, like, there's a difference between that and addiction. Like, just because you go through withdrawal on a drug doesn't mean you're addicted. Has a very specific meaning, you know. And so I just would be careful about using the word addicted.
Keith just tweeted the exact same thing the caller, Kathy, said. Your kid has surgery, your neighbors bring food, support. Depression, they talk behind your back.
Yeah.
There's no hope, which is why we need a national depression campaign in this country to educate people on TV like we do with cigarettes and diabetes and obesity.
Yeah.
Here's what to look for. You know, here's what to look for. And then here's what you do as a provider or as a caregiver.
Right, but we don't even want to pay for it. So it's like, you know, that's a whole other ballgame.
Exactly.
So, and, I mean, it's like, to actually pay for the mental health care for everyone who has depression would be a massive amount of money that no one seems to want to care for. In fact, it's like...
Even the news coverage and even those educated reporters are so undereducated on depression, they can't even speak educatedly about it. And, yes, there's 15 antidepressants and two other drugs that are indicated for adjunctive treatment, but we're still only getting about 30% of the folks to remission. There's no magic bullet. There's no blood test, like you said, but the National Institutes of Health did a study with 4,000 patients, 18 months long. Dr. Trivedi out of University of Texas was a lead investigator, and what they found was it is far, far greater to add something to the antidepressant than it is to switch. The more times you switch from antidepressant A, B, C, D, the remission rates go down, the response rates go down. Conversely, the sooner you augment, the remission rates and the response rates go up. We don't leave half the tumor behind. We don't leave half the infection behind. Why are we leaving half the depression behind? These folks, primary care, they're on the front lines. They should not stop until that patient is in remission, which means symptom-free. These folks are dying every day.
See, it's like I think putting it all in primary care is difficult as well because they have to take care of everything else. The mental health requires specialists, and mental health often. And mental health requires intensive therapy and treatment and lots of doctor visits, and I'm not sure that the primary care network can do that. Plus, there's many...
they're going to have to start because our country, just my state...
Right.
Is 5,000 psychiatrists short.
I'm not arguing that, but that's because we don't spend enough on actual mental health. But we wouldn't say, hey, you know what, cancer's on the rise, primary care docs better step it up. We fund oncology. When we shouldn't be saying mental health is on the rise, primary care docs better step it up. We should be funding mental health. And I think that
I'm just talking about primary care. I don't even call on primary care physicians. I call on psychiatrists.
Right.
But the primary care is on the front lines.
What I'm saying
is they only refer patients 10% of the time.
That's a problem.
They just keep switching from Lexapro to Prozac to Paxil to Cymbalta. They just keep switching.
Hold on, Kelly.
Data supports that that's wrong.
Aaron, what did you say that they about the referral?
The fact that they're not referring is a problem, but often there's nowhere to refer them to. And it's the same way that, you know, we've done such a great job of autism screening and everything else, but now every single sort of autism support system is so overloaded that primary docs are starting to get frustrated that even when they find kids with autism, there's nowhere to send them because we don't fund the back end. We don't fund the mental health. We don't fund the support services and everything else that's necessary to care for people once they're diagnosed with a problem. All primary care can do for the most part is screen and refer. That's what primary care does.
I disagree.
Well, that's fine, but then go talk to primary care docs and tell them while they're already seeing 40
patients
a day,
half the state of Missouri.
They're supposed to add in
all
the mental health visits and everything.
Hold on, Kelly. I want to hear what Aaron was saying as to why.
When we already have a primary care shortage and they're already seeing 40 patients a day and their visits have already been reduced to 15 or 10 minutes a pop, to tell them now also make sure that you do all the follow-up and intensive therapy and everything else that's necessary for all your patients who have depression or any mental health problems is not workable. We don't have the infrastructure to do that. And just to say do it is not a good solution. That's what we've
You're
been
not
doing
you
so
guys
long.
You guys aren't disagreeing on whether or not primary care physicians should do it. I think where the disagreement is, Kelly, is that there's not enough supply for the demand.
It can't. I mean, it's not a difference of will sometimes, it's a definition of can. Again, I would use the same sort of thing we do.
It's a definition of priority. What
should they kick out? Do you think that the other 40 patients that are signing up to see a doctor, do you think the fact that in the United States that it takes a week to see a doctor for like a significant number of Americans when they're sick, they should be bumped back? The problem is that they all want to see a doctor and they all need a doctor. And it's not as if they're saying, I'm not going to see the depression because I need to do another well check. They're trying to see it all. And it is not easy.
Oftentimes they're focused on the diabetes or whatever.
No, they refer the diabetes and endocrinologist. Everyone else has a referral source.
All right, well, it's an, it's an interesting.
If a person is diagnosed with cancer, we don't say, oh, the primary care doc better prioritize that. We refer. When a person gets diagnosed with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, they go to a pulmonologist. When a person gets diagnosed with rheumatoid arthritis, they often go to see a rheumatologist. You've just admitted, and I agree, we don't have the mental health capacity in the United States to compare, to do
that.
Yeah,
I think
Of all the doctors that refuse Medicare, while it's a small number of doctors that refuse to see Medicare patients, the biggest specialty that does so is psychiatry. So, yes, we absolutely don't have the referral.
Psychiatrists are the most likely doctor to refuse Medicare.
Accept any Medicare patients. Of all the specialties.
Wow.
And it's a small percentage. It's a small percentage of doctors who absolutely refuse to accept any Medicare at all. The most common specialty in that is psychiatry, even though there are so few of them.
Herb in Charlotte. I let Kelly go, but Kelly, thank you very much. Very powerful, very interesting call from a pharmaceutical rep. Dr. Aaron Carroll joining us. Herb in psychiatrist says he's a psych. Herb in Charlotte says he's a psychiatrist. He doesn't live in a town called psychiatrist. Go ahead, Herb.
Good morning. Yeah, I just wanted to hit on a few points. Just mentioning, throwing some statistics out. The previous caller said about 30% of people go into remission with medication. That's typically true after a first trial. If people stick with it and go through about four or five trials and try a number of different switches, it's closer to 70%. And I just wanted to second the idea that we need to be really careful how we use the word dependence and addiction. Because yes, it was Cymbalta, for instance, and Effexor, notorious, and Paxil even, for difficulty getting off, but it is nothing like getting off heroin. It's not even comparable. It's uncomfortable and difficult, but it's not typically life threatening. Not as life threatening as the illness of depression. And then finally, I wanted to say there are a number of really large primary care integration projects that have shown a lot of promise. I think it's the idea of just telling primary care to do more is impractical, and I totally agree with Dr. Carroll. It's also true that when you build protocols and networks and you train staff and you offer some additional support staff, even just minimally, you can really transform the way primary care can deliver behavioral health services and make a huge difference. And we have to look at that. We can't decide to all of a sudden train thousands and thousands of more psychiatrists. And in fact, that's probably not even what's necessary. People generally need a good diagnosis. They need to get on the right track in terms of medicine, if that's something that they're interested in. And then you can create protocols to help people who are mid-levels really offer great services. But it takes a real progressive, forward-thinking kind of stance to put that in place. And it's not a popular idea among a lot of people who don't understand how healthcare delivery is really happening.
That's Carol. Well, great caller.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot that's true in there. Part of the problem is, I'm not saying we need – I agree we don't need to train massive numbers of psychiatrists or massive numbers of psychologists or anything else. But we have to have capacity to take the sting off. Part of it is I think people just don't have an appreciation for – we talk about there's a doctor shortage all the time. But I think people don't have an appreciation for what doctor's offices and how hospitals and how inpatient centers often run. It is not that – primary care docs are like sitting on their butts all day. They are, remember, still, and again, I can't believe I'm defending doctor pay, but they are on the low end of doctor earnings. They chose this specialty because that's what they want to do. They're working their butts off. They're some of the most passionate people in terms of caring for patients. I know they want the kinds of long, lifetime relationships with their patients. And they've been shunted into 10-minute visits and feeling like they can't fit people in and figure out there's not enough time in the day to take care of aches and pains and even well care to all of a sudden say, hey, by the way, now you got to massively increase your capacity to take care of people who are very depressed, monitor and titrate their medications.
But they're If you give them a nurse practitioner who can do the follow-ups, and you give them a social worker, and you create an algorithmic protocol that's evidence-based.
But that's
going to improve. You look at the Texas algorithm to treat depression. People did better when they met with the computer instead of meeting with the psychiatrist, because the computer followed without tugging at its heartstrings what's supposed to happen with the medicine. You come and see me, and I feel really bad. I'm going to switch your meds around fast because I want to get my patient satisfaction score up, or I just feel bad, and I'm a human. You don't necessarily need a 30-minute visit with follow-up.
No, you don't, but you still need some sort of, getting that nurse practitioner in and doing that, it all costs money. And while I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, who pays for that? Because we don't think about the enormous fight we have in the United States just about, you know, whether or not or how we can get people more insurance. That is still like a monstrous fight. Trying to change the way that healthcare is delivered and trying to change the payment structure so that we can adequately do that, that is like 10 times harder. And this is, ironically enough, what I do a lot of my research in. Trying to get doctors to follow protocols, trying to get them to change the way that they diagnose and screen is glacial, difficult, impossible work, especially since all of our EHRs and clinical decision support and everything else is so fragmented and poor.
Right.
So
well, I wouldn't say it's not as easy.
No, nothing is impossible.
You just used the word impossible, but I think that's part of the problem. We have this idea that it's impossible, but anyway, I do have to go. I just wanted to say, take a look at some of the studies coming out of the Northwest, out of Australia, where they have integrated this and have found ways to pay. They have convinced the insurance companies it will save them money because it does. It keeps people out of the hospital when you offer good care. So you can bundle these services and you can get third parties to pay once you show them the value of it. But of course, it's very difficult. It does not happen overnight.
Thank you very much. Another great call. Lots of great calls today, especially while we're talking to Aaron. Go ahead, Aaron.
Look at the High Tech Act, where we a couple years ago, we put aside billions, and I mean billions of dollars, just to try to get doctors to get the infrastructure, the EMRs necessary in order to do this. And years later and billions of dollars later, it's something like a quarter to like a third of doctors have what we would consider a basic EMR. The idea that they'll have EMRs which can exchange information with outside sources and move it up and back electronically, you're talking like 5%. That's just to get the thing in there. And that's not even to say let's change it to how it's going to do mental health or how we're going to change infrastructure. I worry that one of the things is people just assume, well, I'm like being a naysayer, like, oh, this is, people could just do it if there was will and it'd be easy and it'd be simple. And therefore, because we don't do it, therefore everybody's being lazy. It would take will of the American people and the healthcare delivery system to massively change how we deliver, how we diagnose, how we define, how we pay for all of this stuff to have a better healthcare system. And I get frustrated only because it seems like it's ignoring how much of a fight there is just over can we get people and pay for their insurance, let alone do the rest of it. And we can't still get past that first step. You know, making these kinds of changes, they all sound easy. But you have no idea how fragmented and how, poorly set up the U.S. healthcare system is for communication and trying to share data and trying to share information and do things as efficiently as possible to care for the patient. There are so many steps that have to come into play to fix this. It would take like a Manhattan Project like Will to say we need to completely revamp the way that we deliver care and shunt it around. And I think your callers have that passion, but I'm not seeing it all the time in the American people.
Lily in Kentucky, you're on with Dr. Aaron Carroll. Lily apparently is a mental health therapist. Lily, thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you. And first I want to say that I really, really admire you both, and I'm glad you're talking about this subject this morning. This is something that's been on my mind since yesterday or the day before when I heard about Robin Williams. I'm a mental health therapist, and what I wanted to add to the conversation is the type of talk therapy that has been shown to be effective, and that is cognitive behavioral therapy. I'm a big fan of Martin Seligman, who I think he's a psychiatrist who's done a lot of work in this area, looking at how thoughts fuel feelings rather than the opposite, and that is the basis of cognitive behavioral therapy. What you think leads to how you feel. And for a lot of people who are prone to depression, what we see is they'll wake up in the morning, start thinking about their problems, think about them. They ruminate is the term that we use on the problems all day long. By evening, they're angry, anxious, and depressed. And so cognitive behavioral therapy has been shown to be very effective, and I have found it very effective in treating especially adults with depression as well, where you really ask people to become aware of negative self-talk that they entertain and oftentimes are not even aware of, and stop back, kind of take a step back and ask themselves, is that realistic? What evidence do I have that this or that is true?
But learn
how to argue against it. And that seems to be effective in treating depression.
Well, aren't we talking about different things here, though? And that's why we have to be very careful with the issue of depression. There's different forms of depression, and I agree with the caller, Dr. Carroll, about you know, Martin Seligman's work and negative thoughts versus positive thoughts. I've talked a lot about meditating and how helpful that's been to just quiet your mind for a few minutes a day. But you know, we're talking about when we're talking about a chemical imbalance.
Yeah, but again, see, this is your assuming. It's like we don't do tests often to see if there's a chemical imbalance. We often
exactly.
just test. And we say, we're going to try this drug because that's worked in the past. So you know,
oh, really?
The chemical imbalance thing is like everybody's assuming. This is why I'm saying
right.
I'm not as on board in sort of like drugs, and that everybody's just using the drugs. There are a lot of people that benefit from therapy and working through it and trying to find their way out of it. There are people that benefit from the drugs. There's lots of people that benefit from both.
All right, let me ask you this question though. What if you know, I just saw someone tweet or email me something that they've been on Zoloft for 15 years. It's like insulin for a diabetic. What if that person simply you know, went to a therapy, practiced meditation?
I don't know. That's the thing. It's like with so many
the problem is you're on a drug. It's costing yourself the healthcare system, and who knows what it's doing, you know, to your body. You know, long term tests. I worry about some of those things. But you could have worked through your problem in a different way. I'm not accusing that person or anybody else of not trying every type of therapy. But
you'll hear me consistently on your show say I always say I you know go with the thing that has the lowest risk for the benefit. So I personally would try. You know, some sort of therapy first, and of course it depends on how severe a case is. But you know,
right.
the patient can't even express. Try therapy first. If therapy works, that's awesome. Otherwise, go with the drug. Part of our problem, though, is that you know, therapy takes an enormous amount of time and investment. And if there's nowhere to put it, taking a drug is a lot easier. And so you'll see a lot of primary
sure.
care docs. They can't do therapy. They can prescribe a drug. And so
right.
that is often where they go.
Can I say something about different types of depression? I think if you've got a really good differential diagnosis, there are not different types of depression. However, we see
level.
Some people presenting with depression, but what one of the things that's going on with them is it was an early, very traumatic childhood. And so it may not be depression. It could be post-traumatic stress disorder. Those folks are not going to benefit just from cognitive behavioral therapy alone. And this kind of gets to something that I was thinking about when you all were talking, and that is that maybe we need to kind of tweak a little bit the way that behavioral health medicine is delivered, because there isn't the, I think partly because you don't, it's harder to make a true diagnosis, harder therefore to figure out what is the proper cure for a particular individual. There are a lot of clinicians out there who are not aware of outcome research on anything and use techniques that are some sort of theory that they learned somewhere, but really has no empirical value behind it. One of the things that I find, I bill primarily Medicaid, and one of the things that I find about billing Medicaid is the state will come in and do an audit. They look through the client's charts. They do a billing audit. If they do not see progress, eventually they will pull the plug. And same thing with a lot of private insurance companies. What that is supposed to do, but I think too often time, well, and hopefully does do, is encourage mental health therapists to be more proactive in reviewing the research, in talking with colleagues, and making sure that they are giving accurate diagnoses and then looking at what has been found to be effective in treating particular disorders. But there's not enough of that accountability going on, and I think that's part of the problem.
Do you agree with that, Aaron?
I think parts of it, yes. I mean, unfortunately, and I think it's great, a lot of things said, still thinking back to the beginning, I agree there aren't different types of depression, but there are just different levels of depression. And there's just, you know, severity. And I think that, you know, when something is more minor, we can certainly have more time and effort and will. But again, it's like, I think all of this is great. I think redefining and rechanging the ways that we grant mental health, I'm all for it. I worry that we don't seem to have the will in the United States to be able to tackle.
Well,
you know, the way
you've mentioned that a number of times, and so I got to ask you because you have looked at all of these other healthcare systems in other countries. Have you looked at how they deal and diagnose depression?
Ironically enough, you know, mental health is often where a lot of these other systems fall short too. Even when we talk about single payer systems like Canada, mental health is often one of the things like, well, I'm not sure we're covering that, or you know, that they, it actually is harder to get care sometimes when you're depressed, or you know, maybe they do a better job with, like, you know, severe depression, but not as good with mild or moderate depression. Mental health is not is less, because remember, when we're talking about these other healthcare systems, we're often talking about financing and paying, and that's the easy stuff to fix. Changing the ways doctors practice, much more difficult. Changing the way that the healthcare system actually moves and functions, incredibly hard. And so I don't know that I would be like, well, you know, they take care of mental health so much better in this place than that place. It's not clear. I bet some do better and some do worse. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do better. We have the capacity and we have the money. We have the resources here. It's just a matter of how we want to spend them. And at this point, we don't do a very good job when it comes to mental health and depression.
Lily, thank you so much for the call and all of the calls during this segment. It's been one of the best we've had with Aaron since we moved to mornings, because we have such thoughtful callers that Aaron can agree or disagree with. And I've learned so much in the last 40 minutes. I can't thank you enough, Aaron. Thank you so much for joining us in this really, really important issue, just scratching the surface on it.
Thank you.
All right, buddy. At Aaron E. Carroll on Twitter. Follow him there. Watch his videos on YouTube at Healthcare Triage. And get his books that debunk medical myths about your body and your health. 3 books now out there for you to get and gift. But most importantly, give him a follow on Twitter. Tell him you heard him here, at Aaron E. Carroll, 2 R's, 2 L's.